Texas's top law enforcement official faces more legal hot water, this time from some of his own former top aides. The lawsuit against Ken Paxton today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. A city's convention center transformed into a field hospital as COVID cases soar in El Paso. We'll have the latest. Also, lessons for the lockdown era, a book to help kids cope with the coronavirus, the twists and turns of Texas elections without straight ticket voting, a closer look at what drove so many young Latinos and Latinas to the polls, and the re-release of a mid-century classic offering a critical re-examination of Texas small-town life. Those stories and much more when the Texas Standard gets underway, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 16th day of November. I'm David Brown. Hope you had a good weekend. Alas, it has been a grim past several weeks in El Paso. There, the number of people hospitalized for coronavirus has grown nearly 10 times what it was at the start of September. The Department of Defense has sent in medical teams, and local funeral homes have prepared additional refrigerated storage space. And now, as the Texas Tribune reports today, the city morgue is so overwhelmed that inmates from the county's detention facility are being brought in to help with the overflow of bodies. The Tribune reports the arrangement is temporary as officials await help from the National Guard. As Texas became the first state in the U.S. to report more than 1 million COVID-19 cases, with numbers climbing statewide, it's apparent no major city in the Lone Star State has been hit quite as hard as El Paso, now averaging more than 1,000 new cases per day. So many people are sick, in fact, the city's convention center has been converted into a field hospital. KERA's Mallory Falk reports on how local businesses and health officials are trying to manage the COVID surge.
Funeral home manager Jorge Ortiz wheels a body to his chapel, but not for a funeral service. The chapel's been converted into a storage cooler. Ortiz runs Purchase Funeral Homes. So many bodies have come in, he had to create extra space.
The last 2 weeks, we have received more COVID cases than the past, months. I mean, when we hit the peak back in maybe the summer, that's not nothing compared to what we're living right now.
His team is trying to manage this constant flow and comfort so many families who've lost loved ones to the virus.
They just took them to emergency. They left them there. And next time they saw them was 2 weeks later when they passed away. They saw them in a coffin. They saw them in the funeral home.
More than 700 El Pasoans have officially died due to COVID complications, though the number is likely much higher, with hundreds of deaths still under investigation. County officials brought in 4 mobile morgues, but that wasn't enough. They added 6 more. As coronavirus numbers climb, state and local leaders have fought over how to respond. El Paso's top county official ordered a temporary shutdown of non-essential businesses. The state attorney general challenged that order, calling it unnecessary and illegal. A court then blocked the order and a countywide curfew. And El Paso's mayor has encouraged businesses to stay open. While leaders clash, some healthcare workers are still calling for a shutdown.
Claro que también pensamos en los negocios.
Nurse Ariana Lucio spoke at a bilingual press conference on Friday.
Pero, ¿qué negocio va a haber si no hay gente, si todos estamos muriéndonos?
Of course, we also think about businesses, she said. But what business will there be if there's no people, if we're all dying? Hospitals are stretched thin. Dozens of ICU patients have been airlifted to other cities in Texas. The state and federal governments sent in extra healthcare workers and more medical supplies.
So within El Paso, we've probably created almost 600 new beds.
Joel Hendricks is chief medical officer at University Medical Center, one of the region's largest. He estimates more than 60% of patients at his hospital are there because of COVID. For now, they've been able to expand, like setting up medical tents in a parking lot, because of the resources the state sent to El Paso. But he's worried what happens when other communities see a spike in infections.
That's why we think it's very important for El Paso to start blunting this curve and decreasing the amount of infections that are being transmitted. If we can do that, then they won't end up in our hospital because they won't need that care. So yes, we are concerned, and certainly we haven't even gotten to flu season yet, which will affect all the nation, and in particular Texas, where most of our resources are coming from.
Some state resources are now going to Lubbock, just the latest hotspot in Texas. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton may be the state's top law enforcement official, but he himself faces no small number of legal challenges. Now comes a lawsuit from several former employees who say he retaliated against them after they accused him of using his office to help a campaign donor and friend. This lawsuit was filed under the Texas Whistleblower Act in a Travis County District Court late last week. It also provides one of the clearest pictures yet of recent abuse of office allegations against Paxton. Tony Plohetsky knows the ins and outs of this story. He's been reporting on this for the Austin American-Statesman. Tony, thanks for joining us again on the Texas Standard.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
Been a very busy several months for you. First of all, let's talk about this latest lawsuit against Attorney General Ken Paxton. Who's behind it and why?
So as we reported, starting in October, seven employees, high-ranking employees, top aides to Attorney General Ken Paxton, began making claims. They said that they were concerned that the Attorney General may be carrying out crimes that include bribery and abuse of office. They made those claims to the FBI. They became public as well. And what they contend is that in the weeks after coming forward, blowing the whistle, that they faced retaliation and intimidation, a hostile workplace. And so they filed this lawsuit under the state's Whistleblower Act to try to get justice for themselves after making these claims about the Attorney General. The claims are pretty extensive and are not simple in nature.
Let's talk a little bit about the underlying claims that were at root here. What exactly is Paxton being accused of by these former colleagues, and what new do we know about those allegations as a result of this whistleblower lawsuit?
At the crux of the lawsuit and of these claims is a question of whether or not Ken Paxton inappropriately used his office to benefit an Austin-based financial investor named Nate Paul. Nate Paul had his offices raided by the FBI last year. There has been an ongoing investigation, as far as we know, involving Nate Paul. Nate Paul believes that the FBI took inappropriate action during the search of his properties, that they violated his constitutional rights. And so he brought a complaint forward that ultimately made its way to the AG's office. And so the claim is that then Attorney General Paxton was working on behalf of Nate Paul, even though his own staff was telling the Attorney General, there's nothing to see here, there is no crime that has been committed. But what the Attorney General has increasingly been saying in recent days is that he sincerely believed that this complaint had potential merits and should be fully vetted and possibly investigated into possible wrongdoing by the FBI.
And essentially, his former staff members believed that he was doing all this on behalf of this donor as an abuse of office, that he was basically helping a well-heeled donor.
Exactly. Nate Paul had given $25,000 in a campaign contribution to Ken Paxton. It is also of note, and this has been reported by the Associated Press, and this claim is also in the lawsuit itself. Mm-hmm. And that is, according to the suit, and again, kind of piggybacking on what the Associated Press has reported, there is information out there that Ken Paxton was having an extramarital affair with a woman who was employed by Nate Paul. And so, according to these whistleblowers, they believe that that is evidence of some sort of, you know, potential quid pro quo, some sort of relationship between Nate Paul and Kim Paxton that goes even further than friendship or a campaign donation.
What does the AG have to say about these allegations and about the lawsuit?
The AG has really not said a lot, although that is changing in terms of his response. He has said really from day one, and he's sort of turning up the volume on this somewhat, but his contention from day one is that these employees were not doing their job, that there was evidence of a potential crime, that they were stonewalling an investigation. He said as recently as Friday that there were other personnel and employment-related issues involving some of these individuals. And so the bottom line is that he's attempting to sort of switch the lens back onto the seven employees and say, I'm not the one who did anything wrong. They're the ones who did something wrong. So, you know, it's a lot that is going to have to be sorted out, possibly, you know, as part of a criminal investigation, possibly in the courtroom with this whistleblower lawsuit that was filed late last week.
Tony Plohetsky is a reporter with the Austin American-Statesman and KVU. Tony, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Zunbar is our social media editor. Let's find out what the talk of Texas is on this Monday. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, that wrenching situation in El Paso resonating with many of our friends and listeners. On our Facebook page, Jessica says, both my parents are in El Paso with COVID. My mom's not doing great, but has refused to go to the hospital because she doesn't want to sleep in a tent, she says. Hard to argue with that. If she were here in Austin, she adds, I'd take her to the hospital, but in El Paso, I don't want to encourage her to go just yet. Obviously, her situation being one where she can defer care if needed, but that's not the situation for many other people. And as for that situation you mentioned earlier, David, the use of minimum security El Paso inmates being enlisted to move the bodies of the dead, a job for which they're paid $2 an hour. Folks are sounding off about that too. Also, through our Facebook page, Mary Sue Foster calls the arrangement so wrong. Meanwhile, John Davis says they should make people that claim this is all a hoax move the bodies instead. A grim story we're definitely keeping an eye on, along with the rest of the state and the nation for that matter, David. It's just one story that we're watching, and I'll be back with more reactions from social media later in the program.
Well, you know, Pfizer was the first to report 90% effectiveness for a potential vaccine. Now, early data shows Moderna's coronavirus vaccine is 94.5% effective. According to the New York Times, there's talk about it being available possibly in the spring. We'd love to hear your comments. TexasStandard.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at RaiseYourHandTexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
Business and Your Money on The Standard. I'm David Brown. If you're looking for what's happening in the economy these days, look no further for a bellwether than your local automobile dealership. The San Antonio Express News reports that sales of luxury vehicles have soared over the past few months, while purchases of used cars and lower-end models have lagged. Some luxury dealerships are posting record sales totals despite being closed for much of March and April. The culprit appears to be the uneven economic impact of the pandemic, and people who make high wages just haven't been affected as profoundly as those who don't. What happens going forward depends largely on government's response to the virus. More widespread lockdowns could hurt used car dealers even more, while a new economic stimulus package could buoy sales across the board.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider. Proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. During this election, Texas saw a million young adults voting before Election Day. With a young Latino or Latina turning 18 in the U.S. every 30 seconds, this voting bloc represented a critical part of the overall turnout. The Texas Standard's Joy Diaz talked to several young Texas Latinos about their reasons for voting and how a movement to get more of them to the polls started a few years ago.
Now, ladies, please repeat after me. Remember the quinceañera protests of 2017?
Can hear us. Bravo! We are brown and beautiful.
We are brown and beautiful.
And we won't back down.
15 young Latinas, dressed in their poofy fairy tale-like dresses, entered the state capitol that day to talk to legislators about how some laws unfairly impact immigrant families. Cristina Sinsun, with Jolt Action, a group dedicated to engaging Latino voters, led that protest.
The girls were walking through the Senate chambers, and when we walked back out, I said, I want you to remember this moment, because in a few years, you all will be old enough and we'll be taking power in this legislature, and we'll be enacting an agenda that protects immigrant and Latino families, that protects the rights of the LGBT community, that defends the rights of workers and students.
From that protest on, other young Latinas were inspired to turn their quinceañera parties into voter registration events. The song you're hearing is a waltz that's often played at these coming-of-age parties celebrating a girl's 15th birthday. Before 2017, guests would simply dance to the waltz. But since that protest, quinceañeras in Texas have been asking their guests to dance their way to a voter registration table and register to vote. Jolt Action was just one of the many groups that started reaching out to potential young voters. Move Texas was another, and Charlie Bonner leads that group.
We have a very robust set of youth organizing nonprofits in Texas. Combined, we've invested millions of dollars over several cycles into building up the youth vote to get the results that we saw on Election Day.
More recently, young voters who may not have been affiliated with any youth organization were motivated by this summer's protests. Such was the case of 22-year-old Jesse Esquivel from Austin. During the summer, she marched. Her 18-year-old sister did too. Esquivel says they know people who have been hurt by police brutality and thought marching was one way to make their voices heard. Voting was another.
I also helped like a lot of my friends sign up because they're all around the same age as me, if not a little older, and they hadn't voted before. And then we all got in the car and drove together to go vote.
Stephanie Frescas Macias from El Paso is 25, and she also felt energized this summer and even decided to volunteer with some campaigns.
I was doing a little bit of registration and doing some phone banking even.
Frescas Macias and Esquivel describe themselves as liberal. The Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University Tisch College has been looking at exit polls and determined the majority of kids in Texas voted like Frescas Macias and Esquivel this election cycle. According to that data, 62% of the youth vote went to Joe Biden, while 36% voted to re-elect President Donald Trump. But the so-called youth vote, like any other category of voters, is full of nuance. Take Aaron Cervantes, for instance. He just turned 31, barely squeaking into the youth category this year, a term that normally applies to voters between the ages of 18 and 30. Cervantes calls himself a conservative and works for the largest Catholic church in San Juan, Texas, but he's pro-choice. So, what motivated him to vote? The economy? No, he says.
Gracias a Dios, I have a good job here at the church.
The number one issue for these three young Latino voters? Immigration.
I am pro better immigration laws. I'm a big supporter of the Dreamers.
For me, it was like immigration.
Immigration is a huge reason why I got into politics, why I started paying attention, why I voted.
Whether conservative or liberal, young Latino voters in Texas are often the children or the grandchildren of immigrants, and how immigrants are treated matters to them. And this is important for candidates to know because it doesn't fit neatly into the stereotypical assumptions about liberals and conservatives. Beyond immigration, Jessie Esquivel says she worries about the environment.
Climate and science. Like, I think they put us in school for a reason. And now that we know about it, we're not going to like let people discredit what we learn. We know that exists. So we're not just going to like, we don't want to see our world die within our time here.
For Stephanie Frescas Macias, rhetoric. The words out of politicians' mouths are a huge issue.
You know, living in El Paso after the massacre, I saw how...
The 2019 racially motivated shooting at a Walmart there.
How rhetoric can have really concrete, harmful consequences.
23 people were killed. 23 others were injured. The last motivator for these young voters, regardless of party affiliation, is the need for better health care. Aaron Cervantes says it's heartbreaking to see his friends in San Juan navigating life without health insurance.
Most importantly, I've also seen them struggle with like being diagnosed with diabetes and not knowing how to get to the proper medical care because they don't have the money for it. So I guess in my mind, it all kind of goes together.
It does go together. People with other medical conditions such as diabetes are the ones most affected by COVID, for instance. Much has been said about the youth vote after the election, both in Texas and nationwide. Here in Texas, the youth vote is overwhelmingly Latinx. And there are two things to keep in mind. One, young voters, like the rest of us, are aging. Today's youth vote will simply be known tomorrow as the Latino vote. Will political parties and political organizations pursue them with the same zeal then? And two, the next cohort of young voters is even bigger than this one. Right now, one of every 10 kids in the nation lives in Texas. Will current efforts to get kids to the polls keep up? Or will they waltz their way out of the state? I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. An official in the Rio Grande Valley is suspending a curfew he ordered in response to the pandemic, but Cameron County Judge Eddie Trevino Jr. said Friday he would reinstate the restriction if infections increase. He also urged residents to continue taking precautions against the coronavirus because resources are spread thin statewide to address surges in other cities.
Amarillo and Lubbock are surging. Cases are increasing in Houston and San Antonio and Dallas and Austin. So I hate to say this, but we're kind of all on our own now. We've got to take care of ourselves and others in our community.
Cameron County reported more than 90 new COVID-19 cases on Friday after several weeks of an average 35 to 40 cases per day. The federal government is fining a Dallas meat processing plant, which lost two of its employees to COVID-19 earlier this year. KERA's Stella Chavez reports.
The Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, issued three separate citations against Quality Sausage Company. The citations carry fines totaling more than $25,000. OSHA cited the company for violations related to the coronavirus. Under standards set by OSHA, a company is supposed to report the death of an employee as a result of a work-related incident within 8 hours. The company came under scrutiny in April after two workers died. Family members of one of those workers sued Quality Sausage for not shutting down the plant after some employees showed possible symptoms of COVID-19. The company temporarily paused production and said it implemented several safety measures, such as testing workers and checking their temperatures before entering the building. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
4 p.m. Central Time is the deadline to file sexual abuse claims against the Boy Scouts of America as part of a bankruptcy proceedings that include establishing a victim's compensation fund. More than 82,000 people have come forward so far. The Irving-based organization filed for bankruptcy in February as it was facing hundreds of abuse lawsuits. And four astronauts are set to arrive at the International Space Station late tonight. Houston-born Shannon Walker is among the crew that launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on Sunday aboard a SpaceX rocket.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition.
This is the second crewed flight for SpaceX's Dragon capsule. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron, Adler, Clough, and Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Dining out just isn't what it used to be. Nationwide, many restaurants are still operating at limited capacity and emphasizing takeout, cutting into profits. And that's just talking about the restaurants that have survived. The slowdown in the restaurant industry isn't just hurting those directly attached to it. It's also dealing a blow to the biofuels industry, an industry that had seen growth as some energy companies look to invest in more environmentally friendly operations. Robert Tuttle has been looking into this trend. He's a reporter for Bloomberg News covering energy. Robert, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into the economic situation for these biofuels producers, how are these fuels made and what are they used for precisely?
Yeah, well, what's happening now is a lot of companies are investing in making what's called renewable diesel. And it's this, what comes out is the same as diesel diesel fuel that you make out of oil, but they'll make it out of, they could make it out of, you know, soybean oil or corn oil, but some of the most lucrative feedstocks for these are used cooking oil, tallow, beef fat. Those are some of the most lucrative feedstocks. And so, like I said, there's been a lot of interest in this, a lot of investment in this because, you know, refineries, oil refineries are finding it very difficult to make it in this current environment. And in the future, it looks like there'll be less oil demand. So they're investing in producing renewable diesel in those plants and the refineries because these have a lot of California has a low carbon fuel standard subsidy. The U.S. federal government has a couple. And so it's a more lucrative business at the moment.
You also point out that San Antonio-based Valero is becoming a big player in this market, too. Just how common is biofuel production, and what was the trajectory of the industry before the pandemic hit?
Before the pandemic hit, there were a lot of projects that were announced. Companies were already seeing refinery, oil refining suffering, the margins hurting. They were looking at alternatives. And so, yeah, Valero got in fairly early. And they have been in the business for a while, which actually has given them somewhat of a leg up in terms of securing supplies of feedstocks. The industry's been around for a while. Just to be clear, there's biodiesel and there's renewable diesel. And biodiesel is a little different because it's chemically different. You can only blend it to a certain extent in your car engine. Whereas renewable diesel is just the same, so you can put 100% of it in. So that's the new thing now, and it's been around for a while. A company called Neste in Finland has been importing it into the U.S. for a long time. California is the biggest market because of the low-carbon fuel standards. Mm-hmm. But a lot of other companies are now getting into this. It's kind of a survival mode because, like I said, oil refineries have suffered a lot, especially during this pandemic. Demand is down. This is and then the future doesn't look so great either because just there isn't going to be as much need for fossil fuels. So we will see. So they're seeing this as a way to survive, as a method to go in to get a subsidized fuel that is going to be that does have a future, especially if those subsidies expand.
I'm talking about the long decline, slow decline of the internal combustion engine and giving way to electrics and other alternative fuel sources, for sure. In terms of the long-term impact of all of this on the industry, what is it as you see it?
Well, this is a way. I mean, right now, the electrification of cars, that's something that's actually, at least in California, most of the credits that go for all the hype about Tesla and whatnot, most of the renewable fuel credits, they can get go to these to ethanol and renewable diesel producers, actually. because these fuels run in existing engines. They're very low carbon emitting, and so they can be used right now. Electrification, that's going to take a much longer period of time. So I think refiners see that, well, here's something we can do now that's going to allow us to sustain ourselves. But it requires a lot of adaptation, and one is securing these feedstocks, and they're looking all over the world for them. You know, China is a big producer of used cooking oil, which they ship to Europe. The U.S. will send tallow to Singapore, where it's turned back into renewable diesel and shipped back to the U.S. This is one way that refiners can persist and survive in the future, even if there's less demand for fossil fuels. Obviously, electrification of vehicles, that's coming along later, but we'll see. I think there could be a future in which you have some electric vehicles, but many vehicles will be running on these renewable fuels.
Robert Tuttle reports on energy for Bloomberg News. We'll have a link to his story at texasstandard.org. Robert, thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
Listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Dr. Kayla Rodriguez. I'm a board-certified general pediatrician in South Texas. I just wrote a children's book. It's called When the World is Sick. The pandemic started while my daughter was just entering her terrible twos. So we were transitioning to being at home more often, of course, trying to work from home, trying to have important meetings on Zoom. So these were very big changes to our routine, and for my daughter, now, you know, she couldn't visit her grandma, who's probably one of her favorite people in the whole world. We weren't able to visit Target like she usually does, or play with the kids at the park, which was also very fun. And we never really sat down to talk with her about it because, I mean, she was only two, right? So we figured she's going to be fine. We didn't really realize how much she was feeling it until some months in. And one day we were sitting with some books. She loves reading her books. We had a big pile of books to get through. And she sees a grandmother in the book and she started saying, oh, let's go visit grandma. And I said, no, we can't. And she kind of went into all the things that she already knew we were going to say no to. And she just starts crying and saying, why? And I said, well, there's coronavirus. And she said, who's that? I don't like it. But I turned to my husband and say, wouldn't that be such a good children's book? And he says, yeah, you should write it. And I said, you know what? I think I will. At the time, I was also thinking a lot about all the young kids I was seeing in the office. They kept coming in with things that were pretty vague, pretty nonspecific, and new to them. So things like abdominal pain, difficulty sleeping, new behavioral changes, which seemed to boil down to difficulty dealing with these new life changes. I think it's really easy to forget sometimes the really little ones, but they do understand and absorb so much more than we think they do. She was the test pilot. Every time she sees it, she says, hey, that's me. And that's also important, seeing yourself in a book or somebody who looks like you. So it's just been like a little resource and maybe a little bit of, I guess, a validation for kids that they're not the only ones that are scared or that are going through this, especially for the younger ones. There's just such a huge benefit to reading to your child. The act of sitting your child in your lap and reading them a story and having them hear your voice, it just contributes so significantly to so many things. So their language development, their comprehension, their empathy even, their feelings of being loved, and it really builds that parent-child bond. And that's just so helpful to the little ones who right now may just have this vague unease, knowing their typical pattern has been disrupted and their schedule's not the same that it used to be. And they just may not have the language to explain what they're feeling or put their finger on it, and they just know things are weird and different. But just that process of sitting with them and reading to them and teaching them these things, I think reading to your kids right now is really, really important. Dr. Kayla Rodriguez. I'm the author of the new children's book, When the World is Sick, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Back in 1966, in a time of great social change across the U.S., the novel Hannah Jackson turned a spotlight on the oppression of social conventions in a fictional small-town Texas. Its re-release this year reveals an enduring relevance, perhaps especially now. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan spoke with the author, Sherry Kafka Wagner.
Wagner's humble beginnings prepared her for a lifetime of observing people.
I grew up in Arkansas, and I lived, my father was a minister.
But they didn't live in just one place. They moved around a lot.
I went to 16 schools in 12 years, and I never went to any school longer than 1 9-month period. So I was the new kid every year, and sometimes twice a year.
As such, she developed finely honed observational skills as a survival tactic. Understanding who's calling the shots and why helped her get by and thrive.
So I think I very early on learned to really be watching.
Those keen observational powers made her realize that people all living in the same little town didn't necessarily see the very same world.
You know, the same phenomena seen by four people might be seen four different ways. You know, it's like Rashomon, that film, you know, where everybody was there, but they all saw it a little differently.
And with that as premise, a 22-year-old Sherry, while at school at Baylor University, began writing the story that would become Hannah Jackson.
Well, it's a story about a family, but it starts with the parents when they're young falling in love, and they live in a small town out in a rural part of Texas.
Wagner built the story in first person, but not one first person. It was written chapter by chapter, each through the eyes of the person of that chapter.
That's right. It's a lot of people's viewpoints and a lot of voices.
The book begins in the 1920s and runs through 1962. The early part of the book artfully sculpts a world that has now long since passed.
I've always been interested in the past and the way it is intertwined with the present and the way you sort of get some glimpse of the future.
When Wagner first wrote her novel, she wasn't happy.
I read it and I thought it was yuck, and I didn't like it at all. And I put it in a box for 2 years.
2 years later, her father died and she went looking for pictures of him.
And I went in to get the pictures out and I saw the manuscript and I read it after 2 years and I thought, it's not so bad. And so I sent it off and it was published by William Morrow Company.
An editor at the company who was going to retire selected Wagner's book as her last project.
Now, this woman was the famous editor Lois Dwight Cole, who edited Gone with the Wind. So I had the amazing and wonderful privilege of becoming her last author and friends with her. And she was just an incredible woman, and it was one of the best experiences of my whole life.
After that synchronous bit of happenstance, she moved to San Antonio to work at Hemisphere 68, the World's Fair that was being built in August of 1966. Her book was published that September. Being a mother, wife, and full-time worker didn't leave time for additional novel writing.
But working at the Hemisphere, I found out that some of the same skills of writing, that observation, that seeing multiple viewpoints, that those things were important and could work in other ways.
Working with the city on Hemisphere to transform its downtown and create something anew inspired her creatively. And over time, Wagner became an international expert in urban planning and museum design, which is how she spent her career.
And I always have seen cities as, just like in the book, as a collage of narratives, a lot of different narratives coming together and forming a story.
Now a new initiative by TCU Press has tagged Hannah Jackson for republishing as part of its Texas Tradition series. So what makes Hannah Jackson relevant to today?
We see in this nation this tremendous tension between the urban and the rural playing out all over the nation, the tensions about the roles of women. So in ways, I think the book kind of fits better now.
I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Hey, listen, if you ever miss an episode of the Texas Standard, you can catch up and check us out anytime at texasstandard.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also ask your smart speaker to play Texas Standard. We got a whole lot more just ahead, including a check back with social media editor Wells Dunbar. As always, you can share your thoughts with us on Facebook, Twitter, or by emailing texasstandard@kut.org. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, recognizing cancer caregivers during National Caregiver Awareness Month. With over 200 locations, Texas Oncology and caregivers can be right here for their patients. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The election in Texas looked a bit different this year because of COVID-19, more early voting, drive-through locations in some places, and lots of masks and gloves. But one big change had been in the works for a few years, the removal of a straight ticket option. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports on what may have been ripple effects.
Straight ticket voting allows voters to easily select all candidates from the party of their choice on the ballot. Back in 2017, the Republican-controlled state legislature scrapped the option, and the change didn't take effect until this election. Democrats unsuccessfully sued to stop the change, but not everyone on the left cared that much.
I was somewhat agnostic on it.
Ed Espinoza is the executive director of the left-leaning group Progress Texas.
I didn't really see it as a huge issue coming into this election. Having said that, you know, there was a surprising amount of drop-off from the presidential race to the Senate race and railroad race this year. And they were the Senate race was the second race on the ballot, and railroad was the fourth race on the ballot.
About 11.2 million Texans voted in the presidential race. That number dropped by about 165,000 for the Senate race and about 240,000 for the railroad commissioner race. Not enough to change the outcome of either election, but...
You know, there were six legislative races that were within 1 or 2 points. And in those cases, straight ticket absolutely could have made a difference. Sure.
I looked at particular District 47, which is Vicki Goodwin's district.
Stephen Haig is a retired professor of government at Austin Community College. He studies straight ticket voting and says the effects of not having that option can be seen most acutely in state house races, like that of Democrat State Representative Vicki Goodwin, who flipped the Travis County District blue in 2018 by about 5,000 votes. This time, that margin narrowed to about 1,300.
The Democratic Party is probably more dependent upon straight ticket voting, especially in the large urban counties. So in that 2018 study, we found that 77% of the Democrats, and especially in those in high minority precincts, would vote straight ticket.
Really, now I have to go through each and every single one when I know what I want to vote.
Denora Alcacer lives in San Antonio and always voted straight ticket for Democrats.
It was a pain in the butt. It took a little bit longer than it should have. You know, it just added a few more minutes to my day. I expected to be there long anyway and waited in line for an hour and a half to vote.
But some voters like the change, like San Antonio resident Lucas Hamrick, who describes himself as socially liberal and fiscally conservative.
So in previous years, I had vote straight ticket Republican. However, this year, I took a little bit extra time to look a little bit more closely at local politics to see, you know, like what the constituency needs versus what the candidates are offering.
He won't say who he voted for at the top of the ticket, but down ballot.
Yeah, as we got to more county level positions, I tended to align, my beliefs align more with the Libertarian candidates that were on the ticket.
And this is where the lack of straight ticket voting might actually hurt Republicans.
Libertarians tend to associate with the Republican Party. It's more like their economic views.
Stephen Haig again. He says Republicans might lose Libertarian-leaning voters in races focused on social issues like education.
Their social views tend to be more progressive. And so I think it might, in the education sense, that might come in terms of their progressive views on social issues, they see some of the things that the education board has done in terms of curriculum and things like that is just crazy.
And sure enough, the Texas State Board of Education District 5, which runs through the libertarian-leaning Texas Hill Country, flipped blue this year. If Republican candidate Lonnie Pope had picked up even half of the votes cast for the libertarian candidate, she would have won. So, the ripple effects of no straight ticket voting are nuanced. It can help or hurt both sides, depending on the race. For now, Texas joins 15 other states to abolish straight ticket voting over the past 3 decades. Only 6 remain. The key swing state of Michigan actually falls in both categories. Straight ticket voting was abolished in 2016, but residents voted to bring it back in 2018. But even with a straight ticket option, more Michiganders voted in the presidential race than in the Senate race. For many voters, the top of the ballot will always matter the most. I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh in Bernie.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on social media on this Monday. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, I don't think I need to remind too many folks out there, but the holidays are almost here and the surge in COVID-19 cases is making for some hard choices around this Thanksgiving. So we're reaching out to our friends and listeners out there to see what their Thanksgiving plans are, whether they're going to be socially distanced, going into a bubble, so to speak, doing something virtual or something else. We're hearing a range of responses, and it's interesting and instructive here in these unprecedented times. Deborah Tate via Facebook says, this week I made the difficult decision not to travel to see family this Thanksgiving. Marilyn Knapp-Litt says, just like the movie title, Home Alone is her plan. And Genevieve Coons-Herndon says she will be participating in a very socially distanced Thanksgiving. Also like this perspective here via Twitter from Evan Mintz. He says, we did our Passover Seder via Zoom in April, and it was fine. Quit throwing a tantrum about Thanksgiving. But obviously, with the holidays right around the corner, and these questions of whether or not, you know, families will be assembling for a traditional celebration, it obviously has folks concerned here as cases are really spiking across the country and in Texas, David.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know a lot of young people are looking forward to the Thanksgiving break, and maybe for good reason, because some of those early report cards are looking pretty grim. The Austin American Statesman has an interesting, really fascinating story on how so many students are failing courses at higher rates amid this pandemic. And this is a trend that's being seen across Texas as so many students are learning remotely from home. There is just a learning gap that a lot of teachers and students, frankly, are facing. And it's a fascinating story. If you have a chance, go check it out over at statesman.com.
Yeah, definitely. And one that we've been reporting on here, I remember hearing from those Texas superintendents who were saying, you know, nothing really compares with that in-person instruction, and that may be responsible for those drop-offs we've seen.
True.
You know, following up on another story you mentioned at the top of the show, David, this new vaccine result showing 90% plus effectiveness for this Moderna, the drug maker there, and their potential COVID vaccine. Excuse me. Interesting comment here via Twitter from Christopher Cox. I believe he's a reporter with the New York Times Magazine. He says that this Moderna result is great news with regard to the cold chain. That's the process in which it has to be shipped cold for to maintain its effectiveness. He says the Moderna vaccine needs to be stored at -4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the temperature of an ordinary household freezer. That Pfizer vaccine, however, required -94 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So much, much colder. So there was some question as to whether or not, say, like a commercial refrigerated truck would be able to carry that one. But this does seem to be a more heartening news here about this new vaccine developed by Moderna.
It's one of many stories we continue to track here at The Standard. You can keep up with the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar. We're going to be having to leave the air for now, but we'll be back tomorrow. Hope you can join us. Till then, have a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.